Yeah, people try to get in touch. Let me know what's going on. All right, okay. Ira emailed us. I emailed the source sheet too, and I didn't understand if he's coming or he's coming late. But either way, okay. So we're picking up this time with class number two on the Bar Kokhba revolt. Having been on class number one is not necessary to chop what's going on in this class. Just to briefly review, we discussed last time what I believe to have been both the proximate and deeper causes of the Bar Kokhba revolt, which is to say that the proximate cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt was the founding of the city, the Roman colonia, the military colony of Aelia Capitolina, complete with an idolatrous temple on the site of the Beis HaMikdash, by the Emperor Hadrian in the year 130 of the Common Era. This temple and the founding of this city on the ruins of Yerushalayim, which had been destroyed in part during the first revolt against the Romans, which culminated in the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash in 70 CE, was calculated, I argue, to inflame the opinions of the Jewish people and to essentially deny to them any hopes of ever rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, which of course very predictably set off a second revolt against Roman power. So what we argued last time was that this was not a move that was made by Hadrian in a vacuum, and in fact, it was part of a long-standing and, in some respects, accidental, deep-seated anti-Semitism that was essentially part of the program of the Roman emperors since Nerva. So as we attempted to demonstrate, many of the emperors, Emperor Hadrian and the emperor that directly preceded him, the Emperor Trajan, found it politically expedient to renew what had been, in some respects, dormant anti-Semitism in Roman politics, because their rule needed to be legitimated by being tied to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash during the first Jewish revolt, and so because they needed to sort of tie their political fortunes to that momentous event in Roman history, they promoted policies that would inflame the Jews, that would recall the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and would attempt to make that destruction a permanent feature of the Judean Eretz Yisrael political scene. So as a result of that, they enforced these policies, and we saw Hadrian did the same, Trajan did the same, Hadrian did the same, that created an atmosphere within Eretz Yisrael and among Jewish communities in the diaspora that made Jews feel that and correctly, I think, that the Roman emperors were not interested in their well-being, and in some cases were actually opposed to their functioning as a people. So what we saw last time was that the cause, if we're going to identify one, of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the second revolt against against the Roman Empire, which was disastrous from a Jewish perspective, from a national perspective, from a religious perspective, was the anti-Semitic policies of the Roman Empire, of the Roman emperors, that culminated in the founding of the city of Aelia Capitolina on the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash. So what I'd like to discuss this time is actually a side issue, which is hello there, star sheets going around. What I'd like to discuss is a side issue, and that is, to what extent can we identify other issues that historians have classically associated with the causes of the Bar Kokhba revolt? What I'd like to do in particular is focus on Bris Mila. People, at least when I learned about the Bar Kokhba revolt in high school, so what I was taught by my high school teacher, my high school history teacher, was that the revolt was a symptom of the fact that Hadrian, the Emperor Hadrian, who was the emperor, the reigning emperor during the era of the Bar Kokhba revolt, banned Bris Mila, and because he banned Bris Mila, along with a couple of other things that the Talmud Bavli mentions, the Jewish people were forced to revolt, sort of on analogy to the Maccabean revolt, and we'll explore that theme in a bit. And that was basically the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So what I'd like to do is try to ground this historical claim in the contemporary evidence, and then what I'd like to do is evaluate that evidence. And what we're going to do together is do close readings of all of the relevant texts, attempt to determine if it's possible, if we can figure out within the historical sources, or if we can present within the historical sources an argument for the notion that a ban on circumcision existed, A, and B, if it did, would have caused the Bar Kokhba revolt. And if we can't do that, what we're going to have to do is evaluate all of the sources that mention circumcision in connection with the Bar Kokhba revolt and try to assess its significance in the larger context of Jewish life during this period. So this is going to be class number two. What we're going to move on to next time is the impact of the Bar Kokhba revolt on the sort of nascent Christian movement during this time. And it's going to relate, as we'll see at the end, to some of the sources that we're about to discuss. So now, take a look just below the picture of the Moel from the famous Seinfeld Bris episode. Take a look at source number one. This doesn't relate to the Bar Kokhba revolt per se, but I think in terms of our theological orientation with respect to the question of what does this all mean to us? Why is this history important to us? I think it's actually a crucial source. And the source is as follows. It's gotten some media attention lately because of the end of the source. I'm more and what it says about tefillin, but I'm more interested in what it says about Bris Milah. So take a look at the source. The Gemara in Shabbos quotes a brisa in the name of Reb Shimon ben Elazar, one of the early Tanaim. Tanya, the brisa tells us, Reb Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Kol mitzvah shemasri Yisrael atzman aleim lamisa b'shas gzeiras hamalchus kagon avodas kochavim umila adayin hi muchzekas biyadam. Any commandment for which the Jews offered themselves up to death during the time when the government, in this case the Roman government, decreed a death sentence upon those who practice it, so those things that the Jewish people gave their lives for, those things they still practice today universally, and it's universally considered to be and acknowledged to be important. So the two examples that they give are the ban on idolatry, Jews don't worship idols, and Bris Milah, Jews circumcise themselves. It's a defining feature of the Jewish polity. V'chol mitzvah shalom asu Yisrael atzman aleh lamisa b'shas gzeiras hamalchus kagon tefillin adayin imeruva b'yadam. There are those things that the Jewish people never sacrificed their lives for, never gave of themselves when the time was called to do so, and the example that they give is tefillin. So in those cases, the Jewish people eventually abandoned the mitzvah of tefillin. Now, it's clear that at the time of Rashi, the time of the Balei HaTosfos, this was certainly true. The Balei HaTosfos at length lament the problem of nobody putting on tefillin. The Smag devotes an entire drusha that he claims that he gave in front of many communities in Ashkenaz to addressing this topic and imploring people to put on tefillin. But in our period already, or already apparently in the period of the Tanaim, if we can date this source to the Tanaitic period, at the very least, it appears in the Talmud Bavli in the 6th century of the Common Era. It's clear that there are certain mitzvos that there was a tradition that the Jewish people sacrificed their lives to fulfill them, and other mitzvos that they did not. The primary example, one of two, given for the mitzvahs that the Jewish people sacrificed their lives for, that were moser nefesh for, is Bris Milah. Circumcision. Yes?
I see a difference as adultery is one of the three.
Right.
And circumcision is a permanent thing. Putting on tefillin, I could think of a closet, put on tefillin, take it off it.
Right. So the practice during the period of the period of the
public, so if they go ahead and kill them, it's like that's so public that he put on tefillin, but the reason is
right, how would they know? Right, in other words, how would people know that's why they were killing him, I suppose. Right. It may be true, but and I think that's a valid point. What I'd like to do though is focus on the circumcision aspect of it, because I think that's a valid question with respect to circumcision as well. How would somebody know if a Jew was circumcised such that they could persecute him on those grounds? Went to the bath, right. So they might find out by accident, but it's hard to imagine, at least superficially, a regime where a person could go around and say, you're not allowed to circumcise anybody, and then you would have to figure out who was and wasn't circumcised.
When did this become one of the big three? I guess what he's really asking.
Oh, when did Bris Milah become something? So that's the question we're going to explore this evening. In other words, what does it mean here when we say the Jewish people traditionally sacrifice their lives, were moser nefesh, on behalf of the mitzvah of Bris Milah? What does it mean to be moser nefesh for Bris Milah? So traditionally, I think the way this Gemara is interpreted is to say there was some sort of persecuting regime that banned the Jewish people from engaging in this practice. The Jewish people did it anyway, and in so doing, they risked their lives. That's generally, I think, how we understand Mesiras Nefesh in a classical sense. And I think in a contemporary sense, when we talk about the martyrs of the Holocaust and the heroes who came through the Holocaust and the victims of the Holocaust who came through religiously unscathed, as difficult and almost incomprehensible as that is to imagine, we here are accustomed to hearing stories like this. People who were prohibited from practicing their faith in the concentration camps upon pain of death or at least horrible punishment, and they did so anyway. Those are heroes, and we traditionally ascribe to them the activity of Mesiras Nefesh. These are people who really gave of themselves. So what I think it would be useful to do is try to frame the question of what role did circumcision play in the Bar Kokhba revolt as follows. What did it mean to, what does it mean to say, if we're going to say this, that the Jewish people were moser nefesh, gave of themselves, on behalf of the mitzvah of circumcision, of bris milah, in the context of the Bar Kokhba revolt? So the best way to, in other words, what does it mean that they did that? Does it mean that they were banned from practicing circumcision and they did it anyway, or perhaps does it mean something else? So in order to begin to answer this question, what we're going to have to do is figure out, are there any historical sources, by which I really mean Greco-Roman sources, because Chazal don't really help us so much on this issue. Are there any Greco-Roman sources, sources that sort of self-identify as being historical, and whose purpose is historical rather than didactic or ethical, as in, or legal as in the case of Chazal? Are there any sources that present themselves as histories that associate with the Bar Kokhba revolt circumcision? So as we saw last time, there are several sources that discuss the reasons for the Bar Kokhba revolt. None of them that we saw last time mentioned circumcision. There's one source, it's a rather late source, from the 4th century, from about the 4th century of the Common Era, that does mention circumcision, and it's called the Historia Augusta. The Historia Augusta is a collection of what purport to be biographies of many of the Roman emperors, from Hadrian all the way down to, forget the last one it is, but several emperors from Hadrian onward, that are ascribed to a bunch of different authors, but they're all really, I mean, computer testing has demonstrated in several recent studies that they're all authored by a single person who just ascribed them to different pseudonyms. But they all essentially tell the story of things that happened during the reign of these emperors, and in some cases we'll see they tend to be humorous. But in this case, we are fortunate to have one line that tells us a little bit about what happened during the reign of Hadrian. And during the reign of Hadrian, as we know, was the Bar Kokhba revolt. So what does the Historia Augusta tell us? And again, this is a 4th century CE text, so it's at least 200 years after the Bar Kokhba revolt. So it's writing from a much later perspective, later than Cassius Dio, which we looked at last time. The Historia Augusta tells us the following about the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt. It says, at that time the Jews also waged the war because they had been forbidden to practice circumcision. So that seems relatively straightforward. More straightforward than what we saw last time in Cassius Dio or Eusebius about the founding of Aelia Capitolina. What this is essentially telling us is very simple. The Jewish people were banned, let's say by Hadrian or perhaps by the Roman governor, Tinius Rufus of the province of Judea. They were banned by somebody from observing the mitzvah of Bris Milah. And because they were banned from observing the mitzvah of Bris Milah, they revolted. Very straightforward. So what I... Aside from the fact that this source is a little bit late, and so it's not necessarily as reliable as Cassius Dio, what I'd like to do is problematize this source a little bit, and then take a look at Chazal. But basically, before we problematize this source, what I'd just like to point out is that this is the basis for the notion. What we've just seen here, that one sentence, is the basis for the notion which is pervasive in historical analysis, although recently has come under attack, but in Jewish high schools, in the way I've experienced them, this is understood to be the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt. It all relates and it all is traced back to this one sentence in a 4th century text, that the Jews revolted because they were banned from practicing circumcision. And all of the sources in Chazal that relate to this question that we're going to look at in a moment are interpreted in light of this one sentence. Yes?
Sounds like they found circumcision to be revolting.
Ah, I'm so glad you pointed that out.
Maybe it wasn't a
gzeira
against the Jews, against us for our religion. It's a gzeira that they didn't like circumcision, period.
So I'm glad you pointed that. I gave you for a reason, I gave you the Latin word, the Latin term that is being used here to denote circumcision. That is mutilare genitalia. That is how the classical translator that I've given you here has rendered the word circumcision. They've translated those words to mean circumcision. Now, you don't have to know Latin to figure out what these words mean. What do they literally mean?
To mutilate the genitals.
Mutilate the genitalia.
Hey, actually, you do have to know. I mean, I don't know about people who think, but there are a lot of Latin words that have cognates in English, but they don't quite have the same.
That is true, but in this case they do have those nuances. In this case, the nuance is exactly what you would assume it to be, which is to mutilate a person's genitals. Now,
I know for sure that the Romans definitely they didn't circumcise.
Oh, the Romans! That's an excellent point.
So,
the excellent point. That's I'd like to address
if
that.
If they did, then it may be more like the religious connotation
right.
to it,
Sure.
What they call mutilation.
So people from people from the Aegean and in and around the Aegean and in this case from Italy have a long history of not circumcising. The first people that the Jews came in contact with whom the Jews came into contact that were uncircumcised in their history was not during the time of Avraham Avinu, not during the time of Yitzhak, not during the time of Yaakov, but during the time who? Before the Greeks. They're a Hellenist. They're a Greek peoples or people hailing from Greece in, that the Jews came into contact with that were not circumcised before the. You know, the Greeks of Alexander, and that was...
Wait, did the Egyptians not circumcise?
The Egyptians were circumcised. Sorry. The Canaanites were circumcised. All Syrians were circumcised. The Philistines, the Plishtim. The Plishtim are not native to the Levant. The Plishtim come from Mycenaean Greece, and they were the first people with whom the Jewish people came into contact who, Beshita, did not circumcise themselves. The only people that are in the Nevi'im Rishonim and in Chumash who are referred to in a derogatory fashion as Arelim, as uncircumcised people, are always and only the Philistines, the Plishtim, because everybody else was circumcised. The Plishtim were uncircumcised people.
What about the Phoenicians?
Our earliest evidence for circumcision in the ancient Near East is Phoenician, or sort of northern Syria. So the Greeks... and the Romans were not just that they happened to be uncircumcised. They thought Beshita, not being circumcised, was an expression of and a vote of confidence in the beauty of the male form. So in fact, although it's anatomically incorrect, Greek art and Roman art, when they were depicting let's say aroused males, they would still show the foreskin. So they were very Beshita against circumcision. They thought it was barbaric. So here, it's important to recognize that the Historia Augusta, in many cases, is not attempting to convey historical information as much as it's attempting to convey humor. And many of the Greco-Roman historians, their method involved telling fantastic stories about crazy, barbaric people that were intended to elicit laughs and give entertainment to the reader. So in this case, if you actually look at what the Latin says, what it really says is not the Jews waged war because they had been forbidden to practice circumcision. What it really literally says is, at that time the Jews also waged the war because they had been forbidden to mutilate their genitals. Now when you phrase it like that, it sounds insane. The Jews waged an entire destructive war against the Roman people that resulted in the destruction of a Roman legion and the razing of 96 Jewish towns, all because they wanted the privilege of destroying themselves in a sensitive area. It sounds ridiculous. And in fact, the Historia Augusta normally treats the Jewish people this way. And I've given you a parallel source. If you look to the right, in the history of the Emperor Elagabalus, it says, among the other insane things that Elagabalus is supposed to have done, it says that sometimes at his banquets he served ostriches, saying that the Jews had been commanded to eat them. What he would do is when he would host Jewish people, he would give Jewish people ostriches to eat. Why? Because ostriches were sort of this exotic, expensive meat that you couldn't really get unless you were the emperor. And it's ridiculous because, as everybody knows, there was plenty of cheap, delicious pig meat that was available on the Roman markets, but the Jews, of course, wouldn't eat that. So the only thing they could eat was this really ridiculously expensive meat, and this is intended, and this is a sort of one of the last things in a long list of things that the Historia Augusta lists as being ridiculous. So among the things that are ridiculous are Jewish dietary laws. So what we might conclude if we wish to read the Historia Augusta in that light is not that it's arguing that there was a ban on circumcision, but it was attempting to supply a humorous rationale for this destructive and ultimately tragic revolt by the Jewish people against the Romans. Now, if we wanted to be, I think, appropriately methodologically skeptical of our sources, that's the reading we would adopt. But let's assume, yes. It could mean. So let's assume for the moment that it means both. Let's assume for the moment that the author of the Historia Augusta really, truly believed that the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt was that there was a ban on circumcision that was put in place by the emperor prior to the revolt. It wasn't just that he was being humorous, he was making humorous use of a historical kernel. Let's assume that that was the case. So now we have to ask ourselves, given that none of the earlier sources mention this, Is there any way to corroborate that this was in fact the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt? So the fact of the matter is that there are sources in Chazal. Some of them are late. We're not going to utilize those. Some of them are from as late as the 11th century, which of course is not useful to us. We're going to look at some of the early sources in Chazal that seem to imply a connection between the period of the Bar Kokhba revolt and Bris Mila, and we're going to have to examine exactly what they say, not what they sound like they say, but what do they really say. And at the end of this, we're going to have to ask ourselves the following two questions. Number one, given all of the sources that we've examined, what can we say with certainty about the Bar Kokhba revolt, and what can we only speculate about? And number two, why is this important to us as contemporary Jews living in a Western society? So, take a look at source number three. Source number three seems to give us an unequivocal answer to our question. Take a look at the Mishnah. I've given you the Mishnah in Shabbos in the very beginning of Perek Rabbi Elazar Demila, the 19th Perek of Shabbos, which is extremely important for its relevance to the laws like Amir al-Akum, asking a Gentile to do something for you on Shabbos. But it's also important for us in terms of historical reconstruction. The very first Mishnah in the 19th Perek of Shabbos says the following. Rabbi Elazar Omer, Im lo havi kli me'erev Shabbos, me'viu b'Shabbos megula, u'v'sakana mechaseo al pi edim. So Elazar says, have a bris mila on Shabbos, right? So there's a classic machlokas between Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is of the opinion, and this is how we paskin, that although bris mila, circumcision, is docha Shabbos, right? You're allowed to perform a circumcision on Shabbos. Baruch Hashem at Yeshiva University, we had one this past Shabbos. You're allowed to perform a circumcision on Shabbos, but the things that are tzarchei mila, the things that are sort of prerequisites for performing the bris mila, but are not necessary for performing the actual mila itself, like for instance, in olden days, heating up water on Erev Shabbos to make sure the child had hot water to bathe in afterwards, and things that are, or carrying, when there's no Erev, carrying a knife from the place where you left it to the shul on Shabbos, those things which are not necessary for the mila itself, those things are not docha Shabbos. Those things do not push off Shabbos. The only thing that pushes off Shabbos, according to the normative opinion of Rabbi Akiva, is the actual mila itself. Now, that's how we paskin. Rabbi Elazar, however, Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, one of the oldest Tanaim, he was a student of presumably Shammai, or Beis Shammai. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus was of the following opinion. Rabbi Elazar held, it's not just that the circumcision itself pushes off the prohibitions of Shabbos, but even tzarchei mila, even the things that are propedeutic, that are prerequisites to mila, those things as well push off the prohibitions of Shabbos. So, in this case, what he's saying is that if you have a kli, if you have your knife, your mila knife, and you forgot it at home, so now you want to bring it through the public area to the house where you're going to be doing mila, and therefore be in violation of the laws of carrying on Shabbos, you're allowed to do that, because that pushes off Shabbos as well. Now, he makes, if you'll notice, the following addendum to this, which is that, if you want to bring it on, the following two addenda, if you want to bring it on Shabbos, you have to bring it megula. You have to make sure that it's uncovered. The Gemara will dispute whether this is because you don't want people to think that you're carrying something else on Shabbos, which would be usher, or because you want to show how precious the mitzvah of mila is to you. Whatever the case may be, the point is, on Shabbos, you have to bring the knife and show everybody that you're bringing it. However, uvisakana, at a time when it's dangerous to do this, presumably because it's prohibited to do this, then mechaseyo al pi edim. Then you bring witnesses, show them that you are bringing the mila knife, then you cover it up, and then you carry it through the public square, and that way everybody will know that you're carrying the mila knife. Now, the argument has been made that Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus is referring to the putative ban on circumcision that was instituted by Hadrian prior to the Bar Kokhba revolt. And that's why that's the sakana that he's referring to, the danger that was present prior to the Bar Kokhba revolt when bris mila was outlawed. Yes.
Why would you assume that? There's other Maccabees, they had this problem.
That might be true, but then you would assume that this halacha would have appeared much earlier in the Tanaitic record than just Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus. So Elazar ben Hyrcanus lived during the destruction of Bais Sheni, 200 years after the Chashmonaim. Yeah. So the 3rd century CE, that's when the Mishnah is redacted in the 3rd century CE. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus lived
before the Chashmonaim.
The 3rd century CE.
CE.
So the Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, the assumption upon which this reconstruction of what the Mishnah is talking about rests is that Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus died before the Bar Kokhba revolt began. Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus, we know, lived through the destruction of the first temple, or roundabout then. It's not inconceivable, the second temple. That would have been quite a long life. The destruction of the second temple. It's not inconceivable that he died before the Bar Kokhba revolt. The problem is we don't know when Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus died. It could be, first of all, that what Rabbi Elazar ben Hyrcanus is talking about is a ban on circumcision that was instituted after the Bar Kokhba revolt. We know that after the Bar Kokhba revolt, the Romans cracked down on Jewish observance, not just of the mitzvah of circumcision, but also of other mitzvahs. And Jewish sources record a whole litany of things that were prohibited. So we know, and in fact, the historical sources also tell us that the Jews were prohibited from entering the city of Yerushalayim, and they were essentially expelled from the environs around Yerushalayim, and that's how we get the Tanaim eventually relocating from Yerushalayim to the city of Yavne, and then eventually, after the Bar Kokhba revolt, they relocate out of Judea and they relocate to the Galil, to the Galilee, and that's where the Mishnah is put together in Galil. But at this point, so it might be that Rav Elazar is referring not to a ban on Mila that was before the revolt, but a ban on Mila that was instituted after the revolt. This is all complicated by the source that you have on the right-hand side, which is, take a look, Tani Idach, we have a Brisa, and this Brisa is supplying the source material for the Mishnah that we just quoted, which is, Mevio Magula ve'ein Mevio Machusa divrei Rav Elazar. Rav Elazar says that when you're bringing the knife for the milah on Shabbos, otherwise you would be in violation of carrying, so it's permissible on Shabbos as long as you bring it uncovered. You can't bring it covered up. You have to let people know that you're carrying the milah knife. And then, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Mishum Rabbi Elazar, now again hayu b'shasa sakana shayu mevien mechus al pi edim. Rabbi Elazar here is being quoted by a later Amora from the fourth generation who lived in the Galil, who was a student of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Yehuda bar Eli, and it's Rabbi Yehuda bar Eli who says that during a time of Sakana, when Mila was prohibited, you're allowed to cover up the Mila knife when you bring it. Now, it's true that he's quoting Rabbi Elazar, but whenever you see the word Mishum, when somebody quotes something, Mishum somebody else, very frequently, or b'shem somebody else, instead of just quoting it strict directly in their name, as in Amar Rabbi Yeshua, Amar Rabbi Elazar, if it says Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Mishum Rabbi Elazar, very, very frequently that implies an extrapolation from an earlier view. So in this case, it seems that all we know is that Rabbi Elazar held that on Shabbos, you have to bring the Mila knife uncovered. It was Rabbi Yehuda who tells us that during time of Sakana, there's a different rule in place. This is significant because in the Tosefta, from which this source is called, nearly every time that we see the phrase Shasa Sakana, it is Rabbi Yehuda telling us something about what happened during a time of danger. Why? Because he lived in the Galil in the 3rd century at a time when we know for certain that these prohibitions were in place. So Rabbi Yehuda very well could be telling us not what Rabbi Elazar held before the Bar Kokhba revolt, but what Rabbi Elazar held, or what could be extrapolated from Rabbi Elazar's view, in the circumstances that prevailed after the Bar Kokhba revolt. And therefore, all we would be able to conclude from this source is not that there was a ban on circumcision prior to the revolt, but that there was a ban on circumcision at some point around the revolt. Maybe before the revolt, but maybe during the revolt, and maybe even after the revolt. So we don't have any clear answer on whether there was a ban on Mila based on this source alone. So now take a look at the next source. The next source is where things, I think, get interesting, where we're going to have to go back a little bit in Jewish history. There are two sources here that I'm going to give you that relate to a Greek medical and quite dangerous medical procedure called, that the Greek sources refer to as epispasmos. Epispasmos, which is what we would today call epispasm, is rather dangerous procedure by which a person who is circumcised, and the Greek medical sources describe it in some graphic detail, which I haven't given you because at least I have a soft stomach. The Greek medical sources describe the following procedure, whereby a person who is circumcised can have his circumcision undone. And they'll sort of stretch the foreskin back and essentially re- or decircumcise a person. The two sources that we're about to examine refer to such a procedure, and it is argued that they refer to it in the context of the Bar Kokhba revolt. And we'll see why that's important in a second. So what we're going to have to see is whether or not we have grounds based on these sources to argue that there was a ban on circumcision prior to the Bar Kokhba revolt. So pay close attention to what these sources say, who says them, and more importantly, what do they not say? Take a look at the source on the left. This is a Mishnah in Avos. Rebbe Elazar HaModai Omer, Rebbe Elazar of Modi'in, now bear in mind, Rebbe Elazar, remember we asked, who was saying these things? Rebbe Elazar of Modi'in was a Tana who died, we know, just before the fall of Beitar, who basically died during the Bar Kokhba revolt. So we know he lived prior to the Bar Kokhba revolt. Rebbe Elazar HaModai Omer, HaMachal al HaSakachim, VaHaMavaz HaSamoados, VaHaMalbim Pnei Chaver HaBarabim, VaHaMefer Briso Shel Avram Avinu Alav HaShalom, VaHaMagal HaPanam HaTorah Shel HaKalacha, Rulazar of Modi'in lists a whole series of things that, if you do these things, if you're guilty of these things, you can be as righteous as possible in all other respects, but you are excluded from the world to come. One of the things that he refers to is Hamefer Briso Shel Avram Avinu Alav HaShalom, a person who negates or who makes void the covenant of Avram Avinu. This, the Talmud Yerushalmi says this explicitly, this is a reference to epispasm, to a person who tries to undo his bris milah. The argument is made, therefore, that... Now, the argument is made as follows. Elazar of Modi'in lived just before the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now, clearly he is dealing with the problem of people who want to undo their circumcision. Why would anyone ever want to undo their circumcision? It must be that someone had prohibited them from being circumcised. Now, if being circumcised was prohibited, was illegal, presumably you would want to undo it. Now, the people who opted for that medical treatment are excluded from the world to come, according to Rebbe Elazar ben Modi'in. So the argument is that there must have been some sort of ban on circumcision before the Bar Kokhba revolt that caused people to want to undo their circumcision out of fear. And because we know that this was the case, it must be that the cause of the Bar Kokhba revolt was that very ban on circumcision. Now,
it could also be that you didn't circumcise your newborn children, and
right.
So you didn't do it to yourself, but the next generation.
So I think what Dr. Schwarzman is pointing out is important, which is that there seems to be a difficulty with this interpretation, which is that it assumes that if Hadrian had banned circumcision, he would have banned circumcision for people who were already circumcised. In other words, he would have had to go house to house and figure out who was circumcised and who was not, and if you were circumcised, you had to undo it. Presumably, the prohibition, if there was one, would have been on circumcising babies anew. In other words, someone who was never circumcised, you're not allowed to circumcise that person.
Yeah, how do you get that
means to undo it? Right, that's... how do I know that Hamefer Brisa Shalavim means to undo it?
Has
Mufarshina
said this?
The Yerushalmi says it. Yerushalmi says, I haven't quoted for you here, but we're going to deal with that question by looking at this next source. I think in order to figure out what this source actually means, we have to look at the next source. Take a look at the source on the right. The source on the right discusses a mashach. A mashach is a person who has undergone the epispasmos procedure. And it says as follows. A mashach, tzarech sheyimol. Rabbi Yehuda omer mashach lo yimol b'nei shu mesukan. Amr lo, harbi malo bimei ben koziva, that's bar kochva, v'ayolobana v'lo mesu. So the Tosefta says, a person who has undergone the epispasmos treatment, a person who has decircumcised himself, he needs to be recircumcised. That's the law. That's the halacha. Rabbi Yehuda says, he must recircumcise himself. Rabbi Yehuda says, it can't be. Why? Because to recircumcise yourself after you've already undergone this procedure, it's like reversing a vasectomy. It's dangerous, right? You don't want to undergo invasive medical procedures any more times than you have to. So therefore, Rabbi Yehuda says, because it's dangerous to recircumcise, so once you've undergone this epispasm treatment, you don't need to recircumcise. Okay. The response to Rabbi Yehuda is that it can't be. Why? Because there were many people during the days of Ben Koziva, as we know, we're going to see next week from the documents that we've recovered that are written by Bar Kokhba himself. We have his letters. We know that Bar Kokhba's real name was Shimon ben Koziva. One of the great things about discovering these letters is that we learned his first name. So Shimon ben Koziva, during the days of Bar Kokhba, many people did recircumcise themselves. So because, and they ended up living long lives and having many children. So we know it's not dangerous. So the original law is in place. If you undergo epispasm, you have to recircumcise yourself. The proof for this is that many people did it during the days of Bar Kokhba. So similarly, this source is asserted to be another source for the ban on circumcision prior to the Bar Kokhba. In other words, why would people recircumcise themselves during the Bar Kokhba revolt? It must be because they had undergone epispasm before the Bar Kokhba revolt. Now, why would they do that? It must be because they were forced to do that. That's the argument. Now, we pointed out already one problem with that argument, which is to say that the assumption that the ban would have fallen on people who were adults and had already been circumcised is dubious. But what I'd like to do is, if you look at source number 5, is I'd actually like to go through, and this with this will conclude, I'd actually like to argue that there is a long-standing tradition in Judaism of the Second Temple period of Jews undergoing the epispasm treatment, not because they were forced to, but because they chose to. And this was a distinct pressing issue that the leading Jewish thinkers of the day were forced to confront within the context of engaging with secular society and engaging with Hellenistic norms. I'm glad you asked that. We're going to actually look at one of Paul's letters in just a moment. So we're going to take a look at what Christianity has to say about this.
I'm just going to say, in the Mishnah, in terms of listing that, it's like nullifying, you know, the breed of Abraham and listing that with everything else, that you kind of get the sense that they were not forced. If that's in that list.
Exactly.
Those things where they lose the Olam Haba, then probably they wouldn't be listed in that way if they were.
Exactly. We don't say Muranos don't get Olam Haba. They were forced. What were they supposed to do? They were onsim. Someone who is forced to undergo an epispasm treatment, presumably they wouldn't have spoken as harshly of those people. It sounds, and I think Sally's right, it sounds like there must be some other way to interpret the Mishnah on the one hand and the Tosefta on the other that we've just seen. So put the Mishnah and Tosefta on hold for a moment. We're going to look at quickly three sources from three different time periods in the history of Bayesheni, and then we're going to come back, and I'll hope that you'll help me in trying to figure out what the Mishnah and the Tosefta really mean. So take a look at source number 5. The one I've given you on the left is from the first book of Maccabees. This is, for those of you who were in the course last semester, I think we may have done some first Maccabees this semester. First Maccabees is a work that is written in Eretz Yisrael in the late 2nd, early 1st century before the Common Era that is essentially a primary source for the events of Hanukkah and the revolt of the Maccabees against Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. And in the very beginning of the book, it tells us about the Hellenizers, those Jews who were attempting to assimilate into Hellenistic Greek culture, and essentially pins the blame for the revolt on those Jews. And it argues as follows. At that time, right during Antiochus IV's reign, there appeared in Israel a group of renegade Jews who incited the people. "Let us enter into a covenant with the Gentiles round about," they said, "because disaster upon disaster has overtaken us since we segregated ourselves from them." The people thought this a good argument, and some of them, in their enthusiasm, went to the king and received authority to introduce non-Jewish laws and customs. Now, what were these customs that were introduced? First of all, they built a gymnasium in the Gentile style in Jerusalem, right? They made Jerusalem into a Hellenistic polis, into a Hellenistic city. They made themselves uncircumcised, and they repudiated the whole covenant. It was an expression of conformity with larger Hellenistic society to undergo epispasm treatment as early as the Maccabean Revolt. On the eve of the Maccabean Revolt, there were Jews who, in an attempt to assimilate, were undoing their bris milah. So already in the 2nd century BCE, we encounter Jews who are decircumcising. The motivation for this is not persecution, but rather assimilation. Now, it's relevant that eventually, as a result of the early days of the revolt, Antiochus would ban several things, the observance of Shabbos, among other things, and bris milah, on the part of Jews who did wish to circumcise themselves. But before the ban on bris milah, there were Jews who were decircumcising just because they wanted to, not because they were forced. Fast forward 150 years, and we get to the great philosopher, the great Jewish philosopher of Alexandria in Egypt, Philo. He was the sage of the Jewish community of Alexandria, and he writes as follows. Now, One of Philo's projects in his analysis of the Chumash is that he polemicizes against two groups of people. He doesn't like people who are excessive literalists. He doesn't like people who read the text too literally. And he also doesn't like excessive allegorists. He doesn't like people who don't take anything literally in Chumash. And he writes the following in as an example of excessive allegorization that he doesn't like. He says, it's true that receiving circumcision does indeed portray the excision of pleasure and all passions, and the putting away of the impious conceit under which the mind supposed that it was capable of begetting by its own power. So it's true. There is a moral, ethical explanation underlying the laws of Bris Milah. It's true that Bris Milah represents something larger than just mutilating oneself, which is to say, in Philo's mind, it represented some sort of expression of modesty or expression of sexual restraint. When eventually, this class will eventually, we're going to do the biblical period and the archaeology of the biblical period, we'll see that this is, I would argue, not the original reason for Bris Milah, but for Philo it was. So Philo thought that there was some sort of underlying allegorical meaning to Bris Milah. However, he says, but let us not on this account repeal the law laid down for circumcising. Why, we shall be ignoring the sanctity of the temple and a thousand other things if we're going to pay heed to nothing except what is shown us by the inner meaning of things. So Philo here warns against allegorizing completely the Chumash, because if you allegorize completely the Chumash, what are you going to do? You're not going to keep any of the laws. The example that he gives is Bris Milah. Now, we know in Alexandria there was an, shall we, for lack of a better term, assimilationist component of the community. And one of the concerns that Philo seems to have had with them is that they were not circumcising. So again here, we see, if not epispasm, then failure to observe the halachos of Bris Milah. And it's an expression not of persecution. It's an expression of assimilation. And then finally, this is, I think, the most interesting source. Take a look on the right-hand side. This is from Paul's letter to the Corinthians, which he wrote sometime between the fall of 52 CE and the spring of 56 CE. So in this letter, now if you'll recall from the first class when we talked about Paul, Paul has a very complicated relationship with Torah law. In some senses, he seems to reject it altogether. In other senses, he seems to want to keep some of it around. This is one example where he seems to want to keep something around. It's unclear why. But in any event, he writes the following to the Jews of Corinth. He says, but as God has distributed to every man, as the Lord has called everyone, so let him walk. And so I ordain in all the churches. So Paul's about to say, this is the din for everybody, and for all the Christians and followers of Jesus in Corinth. He says, is any man called being circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Me epispasto. Right? If you are circumcised, if you have a Bris Milah already, and that was the halacha that you followed, do not undergo epispasm. Is any called in uncircumcision, let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing, but the keeping of the commandments of God. In other words, Paul says, if you are commanded to have a Bris Milah, and you already have one, keep it. If you don't, then don't. The important thing is just to follow God. That's Paul's party line. Now, Paul here is taking a conservative position. Paul is saying, if you have a Bris Milah, and you have the opportunity to reverse it, do not do that. It's important to keep your Bris Milah. The implication, however, is that there were Jews in Corinth who thought that it was a possibility, and in fact, there was opportunity to, if you wanted to, undergo epispasm treatment. If you didn't like the fact that you had a Bris Milah, you could reverse it. This is in the mid-first century before of the Common Era, 70 years before the Bar Kokhba revolt, decades before Hadrian came into power. It's clear at this point that Jews are, and here in the diaspora, are contemplating epispasm not as an act of capitulation to persecution, but as, again, assimilation. I think we can now return to the Mishnah and Avos and the Tosefta. When the Mishnah and Avos says that there were those who were annulling the covenant of Avram Avinu, who were mefer bris shel Avram Avinu, are they referring to people who did so under duress? I think at least 200 years of Jewish practice dating all the way back to the Maccabees tells us or suggests us that this was not the case. If there were people who were annulling their circumcision or who were undoing their circumcision, it was because they wanted to, not because they were forced to. And moreover, when we find out that during the Bar Kokhba revolt, there were those who en masse underwent circumcision again, who recircumcised themselves, we really have two options. Either it was because there was a religious awakening that accompanied Bar Kokhba, that's the explanation that I think is most likely. So people, in the zeal of the Bar Kokhba revolt, and for a certain amount of time, it seemed that the Jews could be successful against the Romans, people underwent Bris Milah again as an expression of a religious awakening. Or the alternative is that Bar Kokhba forced people to undergo circumcision. This would be on analogy to Matisyahu during the revolt of the Maccabees, who did force people to circumcise. And, as we're going to explore next week, there are sources that suggest that Bar Kokhba was a religiously coercive person. We're going to have to evaluate those sources to see if they actually hold water, but be aware that there are those who suggest that. Personally, I think that if you look at what the words actually say in the Tosefta, Harbe Malu Bimei Ben Koziva, many circumcised themselves, if it had meant that they were forced, it would have said likely Harbe Nimolu, many became circumcised or were forced to be circumcised by others. It says that they underwent circumcision. So I would suggest that they did it because of a religious awakening. But the point is that whether or not there was a ban on circumcision prior to the Bar Kokhba revolt, that much I don't think we can say. What we can say is that if there were those who were undergoing epispasm prior to the revolt, it was not because anyone forced them to do that, but because they did it on their own. So now to return to the two questions that we wanted to ask at the beginning. One, what can we say for certain about what happened? Now, given all of the sources that we have, the problematic nature of the Historia Augusta, the fact that we don't know if they're joking or not, the fact that we don't know when Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus lived, and we don't even know if Rav Elazar ben Hyrcanus was talking about the Shas HaSakana or if it was his descendant many generations later of Yehuda. Given the fact that we can't say for certain whether Rav Elazar of Modi'in or the Tosefta and Shabbos were talking about a ban on circumcision prior to the revolt, or perhaps some other scenario, I think we can reasonably conclude that we have no evidence that there was a ban on circumcision prior to the revolt that would have caused the revolt. However, what we can say, I think, with some certainty, is that at some point in connection with the events of the revolt, probably afterwards, the Romans did ban Milah. They did ban circumcision. As an historical matter, I think that's the furthest we can go given our historical sources. And then, yes?
Could you say that, based on what you just said about Bar Kokhba, that his motivation for the revolt was to stop this assimilation stuff that was going on, so that in a sense, He revolts because he's not happy about Jews not circumcising themselves.
That's an excellent point. That's an excellent point.
Okay.
Right, Malvina's point is excellent, which is to say, maybe whether or not there was a ban, and we're going to come back to that in just one second, whether or not there was a ban, maybe just the assimilation was what Bar Kokhba objected to, and that was why he revolted. What we're going to see... And somehow it sort of gets the historical sources, there's this sort of the garbled memory of this turns it into the cause. So it's a worthwhile suggestion. What we're going to see on the source sheet next time is I'm going to give you a distribution map of all of the places in Eretz Yisrael where we found refuge caves, which were where the fighters of the Bar Kokhba revolt, as we know from Cassius Dio, hid from the Roman soldiers, and where they prosecuted their guerrilla war against the Roman legions, the 6th and the 10th legion that were sent to put them down. It becomes clear from the map that the revolt was concentrated, although there were fighters in the Galil, it was concentrated in Judea, and in particular concentrated around Yerushalayim. As we also know from the coins of the Bar Kokhba revolt, the coins, for the most part, all say L'Cheirut Yerushalayim. The coins that Bar Kokhba minted say that they're fighting for the freedom of Yerushalayim. So Bar Kokhba's goal seems to have been to conquer Yerushalayim and perhaps to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. All of this suggests that the cause of the revolt was what we said last time, which is that there was a Roman colony and a temple to Jupiter on the ruins of the Beis HaMikdash, and that was what Bar Kokhba objected to. And because the Romans were trying to show the Jews that the Beis HaMikdash would never again be rebuilt, Bar Kokhba was attempting to prove them wrong. If it had just been about revolting against religious persecution, I think you would have expected there to be refuge caves all throughout the Galil as well. In other words, the revolt would have been wherever Jews were. In other words, Jews lived in the Galil and Jews lived in Judea, so there would have been revolts everywhere. The fact that it was concentrated around Judea suggests that it had something to do with the Beis HaMikdash, with the city of Yerushalayim. So I think that's why I would hesitate before adopting that explanation. I think at the best we can say, in answer to question number one, is that the most we can say, given the limits of our evidence, is that sometime around the Bar Kokhba revolt, probably afterwards, there was a ban on circumcision. Now, in answer to our second question, why do we care about any of this? I think the answer is, mostly we don't. Why? What do I mean by this? Whether or not there was a ban on circumcision, I think is immaterial. What we can say, I think, with perfect certainty, is that in the run-up of the Bar Kokhba revolt, there were those who abandoned the laws of circumcision and who failed to keep all of the relevant halachos to bris milah, not because it was illegal to do so, but because it was inconvenient. And the fact of the matter is that nowadays I think we face a similar problem. So much of traditional religion, and in particular traditional Judaism, is offensive to the prevailing zeitgeist, whether it be maximizing individual freedom or an aversion to a sense of collective responsibility. Now, of course, it's true that we owe so much of the positive developments of modernity to the advent of classical liberal political philosophy and all of the goods that that has brought us, and I think we do no treason to our Judaism to not just acknowledge that, but to embrace that. At the same time, I think we need to be wary of some of the intoxicating side effects of what we would, I think, describe as modern Western society. And that is to say that it becomes very easy when there are so many around us who take it at face value and who take for granted that the way to look at the world is to assume that the highest good for which we can strive is personal gratification and personal liberty. In a political sense, I think that's a good thing. In a spiritual, theological sense, I think it's less than ideal. When we encounter an attitude like that, and we encounter a society like that, it becomes very easy to think that that's, or to rather ascribe ultimate validity to such a view. Because nobody wants to be different. Nobody wants to be different from their colleagues, nobody wants to be different from their neighbors, nobody wants to be too different from the people around them, and to hold a worldview that is too little in consonance with those with whom they associate on a daily basis. And it becomes very easy in such an environment to decide that we'd rather have a set of values that are shiny and new rather than ones that are old, that seem old and dusty. As timeless as we may say they are in principle, that seem old and dusty. The Jewish people of Bayesheni, the Jewish people of the Bar Kokhba revolt, encountered just such a reality. One where Hellenism, which was new, ushered in by Alexander the Great, the greatest conqueror in world history, where the values of Hellenistic society seemed so pristine, so obvious, so inexorably triumphant, that it became tempting to simply say, bris milah, which Jews had practiced, often at great expense, for 1,000 years, were not worth keeping up. And so they underwent epispasm treatment. The Jews who kept the mitzvah of milah were therefore, in the words of the first source that we saw in this source sheet, moser nefesh. It doesn't mean that they gave their lives because under threat of death. It doesn't mean they gave their lives because they were persecuted to hold up the value of bris milah. I think what being moser nefesh for bris milah means in the brisa that we saw, that in a culture where there is such intense social pressure to abandon old, obsolete values that the surrounding society thinks are barbaric, thinks are outdated, when there's such pressure, it becomes extremely difficult to remember why we do what we do. It becomes very difficult to remember the bris shel Avraham Avinu, the covenant that our forefathers entered into 2,500 years ago. More than that now for us. And such an environment requires mesiras nefesh, requires a person to say, as difficult as it is to part ways with my neighbors, with my colleagues, with my friends, some things which are larger than me require that. So nowadays, it may not be bris milah, but it might be kashrus, It might be intermarriage. It might be shuls with a mechitza. It may be any of those things. There are things that the zeitgeist tells us are outmoded, are useless, are out of touch. Our responsibility as Jews in the modern age, in an enlightened, welcome, and in many respects wonderful Western society, is it is our responsibility to be moser nefesh for the things that we hold dear. That is the lesson, I think, of Mila in the context of the Bar Kokhba revolt. So with that, we will conclude, and we'll pick up next time with the impact of the Bar Kokhba revolt on Christianity. Yes?
Even in the foreign world, it's been going on like 100 years. Is that something that you're referring to?
That's a complicated issue. Rabbi Michael Broyd has a long article. I think it was in Tradition on what he calls the Minag America of non hair covering. I'll tell you, at my own personal situation, my grandmother and my mother don't cover their hair. My wife covers their hair. My response to all of this is to keep my mouth shut. You're right. So that I don't know. But I think if we prescind, I think from the immediate context of Kisei Rosh, and I think talk about general issues of how perhaps we treat gender, or how we adjudicate issues of liberty versus responsibility versus collective responsibility versus a sense of responsibility to one's nation, to one's people. I think in some ways we're at a certain point going to have to part ways with classical liberalism as wonderful and as special and as deserving of an embrace as it is. I think that's the lesson of Bar Kokhba. All right.